Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 97, section 6, which is old single column, page 1067. All right, well, we're recall that we did first Isaiah. At the end of the preceding session, and they also touched on Micah and Obadiah there. So we're ready for Jeremiah, who sets the final stage for the most soaring recognition of the real God, Second Isaiah. I think maybe all we really need a predicate is just, recall, for instance, Micah's famous, just wonderfully to the point declaration about God. When he says, "He has shown me, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." And you don't need one iota of modification. That's basically something we talk about all the time. You've got favorable conditions like humble and just, and of course, having a genuine sixth level of meaning, love foundation that you apply as genuine mercy, as you reach down and out to others from that cosmic foundation of individuality. Just that precursor really says it all. You're essentially there. You can probably even suspect without reading what's in the Old Testament relative to these individuals, that probably all that remains to occur is just extending that recognition farther to the margins of their intellectual horizons. That until finally there is no ghost cult God left. From the farthest left to the farthest right within your mind. And then, that you'll see. That's one of the things they mentioned. That basically, it's just a process of recognizing. Oh well, if that's the case, then I need to let go of this. And if that's the case, I need to let go of this. And eventually, the space in your mind gets remade, and all things become new. But it doesn't start out that way. It always starts out with there's some nugget, there's some on-ramp. You're looking for that with the fifth epical revelation. Likewise, you're looking for that point where you get a solid grip and becomes a new foundation point, becomes a cornerstone, maybe you could say. And from that point, you then just need to expand your recognition throughout the entire text, so that all things become new. And much more than someone in the 6th century BC could ever recognize, just how many things need to become new. Everything from fundamental physics to the universal father, the whole spectrum. All right, so let's see what they give us here, Jeremiah.
Section 6, Jeremiah the Fearless. While several teachers continued to expound the Gospel of Isaiah, it remained for Jeremiah to take the next bold step in the internationalization of Yahweh, God of the Hebrews.
Bold, yeah. So he's probably going to get in trouble for that, you can suspect right away. Just that little tiny paragraph of a predicate is wanting you to pause and just remind yourself of where we are. Remember how we were pushing through the 7th century B.C. with first Isaiah, Micah, and Obadiah. Now we're ready for that transition into the 6th century B.C. With Jeremiah. And, of course, the fall of Jerusalem and the exile of the southern kingdom, the exile of Judah into Babylon. We're now with this discussion stemming from the Melchizedek missionaries, focusing in microscopic detail relative to the other parts of the world on what's flowing forward from the Melchizedek missionaries' influence. We finally have arrived at that seminal century here of the 6th century B.C. And Jeremiah is taking us across that threshold into that dawn of recognition. All right, so you can see you've got this great big paragraph that's going to basically point out the next bold step. What do we have here?
Jeremiah fearlessly declared that Yahweh was not on the side of the Hebrews in their military struggles with other nations. He asserted that Yahweh was God of all the earth, of all nations, and of all peoples. Jeremiah's teaching was the crescendo of the rising wave of the internationalization of the God of Israel. Finally and forever did this intrepid preacher proclaim that Yahweh was God of all nations, and that there was no Osiris for the Egyptians, Bel for the Babylonians, Asher for the Assyrians, or Dagon for the Philistines. And thus did the religion of the Hebrews share in that renaissance of monotheism throughout the world at about and following this time. At last, the concept of Yahweh had ascended to a deity level of planetary and even cosmic dignity. But many of Jeremiah's associates found it difficult to conceive of Yahweh apart from the Hebrew nation.
Okay, you get the gist of it, right? In that first statement, the Yahweh was not on the side of the Hebrews in their military struggles with other nations. People that are still basically in a tribal mode. That's a pretty courageous thing to say. To put forth such a an initial definitive challenge to his listeners to begin to separate church and state. Remember how we talked about that early on? Back to Samuel. Okay, that's too early to be thinking separation of church and state. You kind of need them together to propel things forward in earlier times. But you can see the more you take God up, the more it becomes apparent that religion and statecraft are separate domains. You have some?
Well, I was just looking at the title of the prior paper. It's Yahweh, God of the Hebrews.
Yes.
Yeah, now we're making the transition.
Yes, it is definitely leaving merely the God of the Hebrews behind, between the lines of saying no Osiris for the Egyptians, Baal for the Babylonians, etc. What that in effect is saying is the degree to which those monotheistic or quasi-monotheistic God concepts are valid, they're talking about the same God. Yeah. And that's another issue that's sort of between the lines there. Once you make the declaration definitively, like he's doing here, that he's God of all peoples, right? The degree to which you think that the reason that you are invoking the name of God is because God has reached down to you, right? It's just a simple bit of reasoning to conclude that, oh, it doesn't matter what people were talking about. If they're reaching up to some quasi-transcendent God concept, I mean, that's just sure sign that the one God has touched them, and they're responding to that downreach with an upreach. Okay. So, you know, it just has sweeping consequences philosophically, for a people when they get God high enough, right? It just changes your whole sense of others. And where do tribal lines go now? Right? You no longer have any obvious way to draw a boundary line between them and us. And so, you can see it in reverse. When tribal, effectively tribal boundary lines start to get drawn again, that's because the God concept is waning, in elevation. And it's coming down and disappearing, right? So that it appears that there's some way to draw a line between you and others. Like we're seeing now, right? It just goes hand in hand. You can't transcend tribes without an uplifted concept of God. Long term, you can't transcend it without a top down concept of a real God, right? Some sort of bootstrapping up of anthropomorphic notions. It's not going to be an enduring solution to tribalism. You need to just start anew from the top down. Right? That's that big transition in going from tribe to nation. And when it, like I said, when you start to get tribalism back, again, what's happened? Material gravity has rotated things 180 degrees, right? Just flopped it around again. All right, let's see.
Somebody won a battle, it was credence to that God.
Right. Yeah, and vice versa, right? If you lost a battle, boy, what that said about your God. Yeah. And then what does that say about you? How do you ever maintain self-respect, when you're in that mode? Your whole sense of self-worth is dependent upon, you decimating everyone around you. A pretty primitive modality to shore yourself up.
Can I say one thing about the tribalism and how it's taking over? Hmm. The lesson for me reading this is I have to see this one God as their God too, because it's easy for me to say they have no God, they're subhuman. I don't know, I have to rethink it. So there has to be a way with all this tribalism and craziness to rise above it and ride a different wave. Yeah. There just has to be.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah. I will go crazy.
Right. I mean, I was speaking to that at the end of the session last week, right? I mean, that very issue. Just notice how, forget about the fifth epical revelation. Notice how any semblance of relationship to Jesus' message, even through the New Testament, is fading from view when you convince yourself that it's okay to think that God looks at them differently, or I have a right to hate them, or it's like, no, Jesus said, love your enemies. Right? That made it into the New Testament.
These are times for great revelation.
Right? I mean, it's just... like we've been saying a couple times, as these prophets start to really get it, it's like, whoa, imagine what the world would be like if we could just, get to Amos, right, or something, right? I mean, forget about Jesus. I mean, it's like, if that's too big a step, how about Amos? Can we all agree on Amos? No. I mean, we're getting way more primitive than someone well before the spiritual quickening of the 6th century B.C. It's a sad state of affairs. All right, let's see what else we have there. Oh, right, and then you see it right there. I was just mentioning the 6th century B.C. And thus did the religion of the Hebrews share in that renaissance of monotheism throughout the world at about and following this time, the 6th century B.C., what they're referring to there. Right. So, I mean, you know, all this Melchizedek receiver effort to give these booster shots using genuine prophets, you know, amongst the Hebrews. Even that, see, when all is said and done, you know, when you see 2 Isaiah, it's like, yeah, okay. But in the end, you really needed the mother to quicken things in the 6th century B.C., just like she did with, you know, Lao Tzu or whomever, right, during the 6th century B.C. I mean, that's what really brought everything to a focus. All of this micromanagement stuff was, you know, kind of dragging things along, but it didn't awaken in full, independent, internal flower until that spiritual quickening in the 6th century B.C. The Hebrews are no different than anyone else on the planet in that regard. We would have oh so little without that. Because even this stuff that was before it, you know, would have had an all the greater tendency to fade from view with time without what happened in the 6th century B.C.
Since that was worldwide, what do you see as the predicate for that?
There, you know, when you're talking about the, you know, the parts benefiting from the action of the whole, that's the whole point is you can't speak of an analytic predicate, right? It's not an analytic phenomenon that you can, you know, think of linearly with, you know, causes and effects like that, you know, predicates. I mean, it just for reasons that not even extremely high finite beings understand, these things just come to pass. When all is said and done with the finite domain, trillions of years from now, everyone will be able to look back and appreciate why that happened, you know, then and there. But there's nothing more inappropriate when you see one of these sorts of events to think that it really is about your world or your location or those people. Or, by definition, it's every single time and place in the entire finite is equally the predicate for it. It's a completely synthetic thing, right? You know, it's like saying that you can understand exactly the predicate of a personalized adjuster appearing on the scene, right? It's the same sort of thing. It's like no one can claim to have analyzed that and know the predicates, right? Because it has to do with transcendent wholeness. You know, in that case, right, you've gone all the way to infinity. But for the 6th century B.C., right, all that's required for that is some wholeness of supremacy. It could go beyond that, but that's all that's necessary. Is it in the wholeness of the total finite, it must be then and there. And everyone can just say, thank you, right? And go with it.
So to me, it's kind of like, you know, when it talks in the book about that that men or a whole generation of men will stop the search for God, but that can't last very long because of the fact that thought adjusters are there inside everybody. So basically what I hear, these things happen that seem to be fortuitous, but that's because the whole universe is fortuitous.
Right.
I mean, it's all set up to progress and not digress. And so even though it goes this way, these things happen just for that same kind of concept.
Right.
I mean, this trouble we're in right now isn't going to last. I mean, if you believe it is, you're wrong.
Yeah.
It just won't. It, and it won't, because of the fact that powers greater than us are in charge.
And see, and even though there's individual powers greater than us in charge, I mean, there's something even greater than any part. Yeah. There's the whole. The parts are subject to the whole.
But they work together.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the higher the part, the more, you know, you can't really, you know, see any light between the whole and the parts, right? But still, you know, just at least, you know, conceptually, you know, you have to just forget about the parts. They're irrelevant, you know. The parts have nothing that they can do but be subject to the whole. The ancients of days are high, you know, personalized deity beings and whatnot, but they're just a part in a whole, right? And the whole wins, right? The whole is already complete and perfect, and eventually every part has to face that fact, whether the part's a high part or a low part, or that part's a creator or a creature, right? It's just the way it is. Right. And knowing that, you know, like, it's why I emphasize all the time, that's the great thing that the fifth epical revelation is trying to introduce. It's why we start out, you know, each session the way we do. This distinction is vital. Right? Because that's what's been missing from everyone's thinking, be they physicist or religionist, forever. Right? Physics is fundamentally false because it doesn't posit a whole. It just posits parts and then magic to connect them together. And the same way with all religious thoughts. That's what's missing. Right? That's why everyone eventually goes illogical in their thinking.
And it doesn't mean as a part you don't do your part.
Yeah, you got to do your part. But, you know, well, what's my part? See, well, I mean, if there isn't a whole, you can't ask, you know, what part am I, you know, am
whole,
I supposed to
that's
do?
That's the whole journey. Right? To me, that's what your part is. See? And how you fit in with a whole.
Yeah, and what was Lucifer saying fundamentally? He's saying, there is no whole. Right? Every part is an absolutely self-defining, you know, island universe. Right? That doesn't need a whole. I mean, that's fundamentally what he's saying in the rebellion, right? And then, you know, and then based upon that, you know, what do? Well, you confederate, you know, the island universes together in the plane. No, there's a whole, and the whole, you know, when all is said and done, just is, right? I mean, you have free will, but not the free will to define yourself independent of the part and continue to exist, right? If you achieve using your free will to absolutely separate yourself from the whole, you cease to exist. Parts can't exist by themselves, not even the universal father, right? He gave up that ability to exist independent just by himself, right? So that others could exist, and so that, you know, there could be a place for those others to exist. Put himself in cooperative subordination to the whole. Right? He said, "I'm going to just be a part. Sure, I'm an infinite part, right? But I'm just going to be a part. I'm going to let go of being the whole." Right? And that's how the story begins. As soon as he liberates himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, right? There's a story that rolls forward from that. He has to, subordinate himself to a whole.
Yeah, I see. There's a tension between the parts and the whole. And I can see it may appear that like multiculturalism, it might appear to someone embracing that they're going to define all cultures as equal and then exalt them together, and we'll have this new peace and unity underneath this quasi-whole. Mm-hmm. But it's it seems superior to them than the reality, which there's a tension between the parts and the whole. The tension's never going to go away until all the parts are in coordination with the whole.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you don't get peace on earth and brotherhood among all men until everyone puts themselves in cooperative subordination to the whole. That's where it comes from. Right? All right. Yeah, you get kindred minds by everyone putting themselves in cooperative subordination to the whole. Right? The whole is what every part can have in common so that they can be in genuine relationship one to the other. It is the common foundation. You can't have one part saying, I'm what you all have to have in common. Right? Not even the Universal Father is demanding that you make him, right? That common foundation. Now he's saying, join me in the common foundation. Not make me the common foundation.
Yeah. Individual to individual.
Right? In the same way that eventually you need to graduate from your child of God relationship to Jesus, where you believe in him, and get to an adult of God relationship to Jesus, where you believe with him. See? Right? Right? Eventually, the Father wants you to be with him in cooperative subordination under the whole. That's what he's asking you, to join with him. You know, not melt yourself and disappear within him.
That's not his will.
No. His will is that you be an absolutely independent part in a whole that's even transcendent to him.
Right? Yeah. Consider the finality or oath. Not to the Father.
I mean, when he says, be you perfect even as I am perfect, what's the definition of his perfection? Is it self-defined? Or is he in perfect coordination with the whole? Right? His perfection is defined relative to the whole. It's not self-defined. He's not self-righteous. Right? Any more than you should be striving for self-righteousness. I mean, this is the fundamental point that the fifth epical revelation is trying to make. Right? And when you make that fundamental point, everything changes. Your sense of self changes. Your concept of God changes. Remember that as well. Your ideas of the Father need some improvement. This is the fundamental reason they need improvement. Right. You know, the recognition of the ideal of God, as we're about to read with 2 Isaiah, doesn't need improvement. But that's the ideal of God. Right? The idea of God, see, in order to have an idea, you need a context to frame that idea. Right? And so that's what's always been missing, the bigger picture. Right? You know, until now, no revelator has ever said, I want you to expand your consciousness and so that you actually go beyond the margins of your conception of the Universal Father. Right? I want you to go above and beyond his infinity to even greater infinities. Right? And the existential step of getting to the Paradise Trinity is just the very first step. There's infinities a lot greater than that that you eventually need to, you know, conceptualize in order to really make sense of it all. And the book carries you through that, you know, at least gives you suggestions that will eventually allow you to carry yourself through that exploration all the way to the Trinity Infinite. Very beyond the Universal Father. Right. You know, the Paradise Trinity is just beyond. Right? Yeah. But the Trinity Infinite is beyond, 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 beyond the Universal Father. I mean, yeah, this is so beyond the scope of the majesty that we're about to read. Like I said, with 2nd Isaiah. So if you're feeling your relationship to the Universal Father, you can't really read a few of these quotes from 2nd Isaiah and hold your composure emotionally. Even right, they're so powerful. You recognize the recognition of the ideal, but when you multiply that by infinity to the infinity power, right, to bring in the rest of it, it's pretty glorious what the fifth epical revelation does in bringing in, a way of thinking about wholeness, a way of, the concept of deity, transcendent of individuality, transcendent of God. Okay. But notice, we just kind of get to back here. We haven't really gone that far, even though it sounded like we were way off on a tangent there. Yahweh had ascended to a deity level. See, it says it right there. Right? Of planetary and even cosmic dignity. Right? See? Right? Like I said, these guys are getting to the threshold of what the fifth epical revelation is attempting to lay out. Right? Not just spiritual dignity, cosmic dignity. Okay, and not merely God, but deity. Right?
It says dignity. Right?
Just notice that.
Deity level, yeah.
Yeah, cosmic, not just merely spiritual dignity, but cosmic dignity, right? And deity as well. Okay.
So how many people do you think got this in his time?
As we'll see here in a couple paragraphs, his immediate audience, not so much.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he's really speaking to a people that aren't as parochial as basically the Hebrews are. Things are starting to be said that it's more likely that someone in Mesopotamia will recognize what's being said. And the better amongst the Hebrews will kind of challenge themselves to catch up. I mean, this is demanding that you find some Andite uplift sort of within you, right? And make use of it to get above the ghost cult God.
Jeremiah also preached of the just and loving God described by Isaiah, declaring, quote, "Yes, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn you." Quote, "For he does not afflict willingly the children of men."
Yeah. And just using that visualization, have I drawn you? Right? Spiritual gravity, right? The drawing power. The spiritual gravity of the spiritual father. Just see how they can feel it, right? They're reflecting enough to notice that this is the appropriate way to describe their experience. Right? They aren't just this isn't just mere intellectual assent to some dogma. They've been inexorably drawn to something that just is, right? Whether they like it or not, whether it's been dogmatized or not, it just right. That. So you see, it's becoming more and more an exercise in courageous and independent cosmic thinking, more of a genuinely individual effort, genuine religion. Okay.
Said this fearless prophet, quote, "Righteous is our Lord, great in counsel and mighty in work. His eyes are open upon all the ways of all the sons of men. To to give everyone according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. End quote. But it was considered blasphemous treason when, during the siege of Jerusalem, he said, quote, "And now have I given these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant." End quote. And when Jeremiah counseled the surrender of the city, the priests and civil rulers cast him into the miry pit of a dismal dungeon.
Thinking that that would be the end of him, but no, he endured through all this. I mean, it's going to get back to Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, do you suppose Nebuchadnezzar might show him some deference for such a magnanimous statement on his part? Yeah. No, I mean, Jeremiah makes it out of the pit and goes on to a long life.
He really was a bullfrog.
And that's not talked about in the graduate.
I can't even remember how much we're going to get some of that detail up here and we read a little bit more. But, you know, you can just, look up the history of Jeremiah. Like I said, it was basically hinted at when that whole bit that he's not on the side of the Hebrews and their military struggles with other nations. Okay, but here it is, point blank, right? Into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. Right. So think about how contrasting to a tribal mentality this is. This is saying that person of that other tribe, their leader, right, is doing God's bidding relative to you when he defeats you. And notice it's blasphemous treason. You don't have separation of church and state, right? So treason, it's a crime, and blasphemy, it's a sin. It's a sin crime. it's everything. It's a total abomination, right?
It doesn't get any worse than that.
Right. But, like I said here a moment ago, Jeremiah, weathers the whole, destruction of the temple, and at the end of the siege of Jerusalem there and everything, and who gets the last laugh in all this? You see why they say fearless. I mean, just boy, to just say something like that. You've got the exact same mentality today as you did back then, and those peoples there. I mean, to say something like that to their face, Allah loves the infidels just as much as you, right? To give a kind of a contemporary analogy,
yeah.
Parallel, not analogy, parallel. It's pretty fearless stuff. The way he's saying there that each person is judged individually. Get to draft with the pack. Right? If God is going to see integrity in you, it has to be of your own accord. Right? And, it's not just, I'm with him. Right? And you get a pass.
And I'm not getting any credits for being a Presbyterian.
Right. It's just, all the things that are, basically tribals, political parties, religious sects, religious denominations, whatever, all all these things, you know, where each sect, each denomination, each party has its leader, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's, you know, if your religion is down amongst that, you don't have real religion. And if your God is down amongst all that, you don't have the real God. That's just the facts. It's not Chris saying that. That's these ancient prophets saying that. Right?
Would Jesus say, but I did not know you?
Right. Right. It's like, I talked about you all the time, God. No, you talked about the ghost cult God notion. You didn't talk about me. Right? I never knew you. Yeah, you talked about the so-called Christian God or the Muslim God or the Buddhist God, you know, or whatever. What about the real God? The real God has Nebuchadnezzar just as much as his son as you. You know, counsel to surrender of the city. I'd say, okay, throw him in the hole. you know, and of course, you know, they're, you know, they didn't just kill him. There's all sorts of political machinations going on, you know. But, you know, they're hoping that he will die, right? But, you know, it won't be at their hand, quote unquote. Right? You know the way these guys are. You know, eventually you got the Pharisees, you know, with all their minutia technicalities that they're trying to, you know, live by and, you know, get around and whatnot, you know. Right, so they were doing it back then, too. It was their effective pilot moment, right, of washing their hands of it. By not just, you know, stoning him to death or whatever on the spot. Okay. No, but notice, see, that's just a... they just give you that kind of little
snippet.
Yeah, that little snippet, that little, because we aren't really going through the whole history. We're going to do that, you know, and later in the paper here, like we've seen, like they did with Elijah. You know, they're just trying to follow in synopsis the evolution of the God concept, right? And they just want to point out how, like I said, Jeremiah supplies that final fulcrum point that second Isaiah can leverage off of and finally lift himself up, lever himself up, transcendent of the ghost cult God, you know, and really put words to the real God in full glory, full power, full flower. So let's do it here. Let's get to 2 Isaiah.
Section 7, the 2 Isaiah. The destruction of the Hebrew nation and their captivity in Mesopotamia would have proved of great benefit to their expanding theology had it not been for the determined action of their priesthood. Their nation had fallen before the armies of Babylon, and their nationalistic Yahweh had suffered from the international preachments of the spiritual leaders. It was a resentment of the loss of their national God that led the Jewish priests to go to such lengths in the invention of fables and the multiplication of miraculous appearing events in Hebrew history in an effort to restore the Jews as the chosen people of even the new and expanded idea of an internationalized God of all nations.
Okay, so we saw this over and over again in other parts of the world. With the, if what Melchizedek Machiavelli, you know, seeded into the evolutionary stream was about to really break forth, the priests step in, you know, and tie boat anchors on everything, at least, if not completely, just blow it away. So we got this very off, you know, this very parallel story here, as we've seen, oft repeated story. But notice the, what, you know, Think about what the last thing they said about Jeremiah was before they said the first thing here. The destruction of the Hebrew nation and their captivity in Mesopotamia would have proved of great benefit to their expanding theology. Oh, in that sense, Nebuchadnezzar was doing God's work. See? They're trying to get you to put, by juxtaposing those two, to get you to put two and two together. Right? You know, in the wonderment of providence, real providence, right? That whole, the presence of the whole, that vast conspiracy of the whole. Right? This was exactly what they needed. The destruction of the Hebrew nation and their captivity in Mesopotamia was just precisely what would have produced an even more glorious recognition, in an evolutionary sense, of the real God. The priests stepped in and muddied the waters as much as they could. I mean, if it wasn't for the transcendent majesty of what Second Isaiah said, right, they would have been completely successful, probably. As we'll see here in a second, they point that out. So it's another interesting little historical vignette that it's like, oh, but for, you know, like we saw with, you know, if the followers of Jesus that went to the east of the Jordan, if they hadn't been so rigid, you know, right? I mean, you wouldn't even have had Islam, right? All those Arabs would have been incorporated into a more genuine religion about Jesus. They even would have helped, I'm sure, to not have it get so lopsided to what Paul was doing.
Yeah.
Right? Would have brought some better balance into Christianity. And instead, Christianity ended up pretty lopsided, and right, you had to produce a whole religion of the sword to bring the Arabs into a more of a nation-like mode. It's all these interesting little tidbits they give you about, you know, but for. All right, let's see what else we have there. We'll get lots about what they're saying there, which is, again, you thought what Jeremiah said was blasphemous, right? I mean, how about the invention of fables and the multiplication of miraculous appearing events in Hebrew history? Yeah, we're about, when we get through 2 Isaiah, we're getting into the blasphemy part. Right, where they say, yeah, you know that whole so-called sacred history thing. Right. It's fables and, multiplication of miracles.
The word of God.
Yeah. See, in the same way that, one of the reasons why Jesus became so popular, around the planet is because his story was told, in fable form, right, with stars of Bethlehem and, some of the classic elements of the fables that everyone told. And lots of juicy miracles. That sells.
And a virgin mother and all that.
Right, right. The fables, right? I mean, you got to have a virgin birth and, right.
Those are similar fables of other people.
Right, right. Those are literally fables. That's the common fable. And if that fable isn't there, no one's going to accept it as valid. Without that, everyone knows, right, that it's not valid. That's why they told the Jesus story in that fable form. Right? That's the rote form, would make him believable to people. And of course, eventually, you get post 3 centuries of enlightenment, and it's what makes Jesus unbelievable, right? To most, the story of Jesus unbelievable to most modern people. They go, that's just the fable, right? They know it's just the fable. Right. They'll point out that all of Western civilization really, you know, these boat anchors are not just on the evolution of the God concept amongst the Hebrews. Those boat anchors I was just talking about, that's on all of Western civilization. The fact that you end up with the Old Testament like it is. I mean, that's, we've been laboring under that. All of Christianity has been laboring under it. All of Western civilization has been laboring under efforts of those Jewish priests during the exile. Right? The fifth epical revelation is the first effort by those in charge to try to help us to finally liberate ourselves from the bondage that we've all been in, you know, the shackles put on by these Jewish priests. It's just shackled all of Western civilization. Doesn't mean that evolution hasn't, you know, made lemonade out of lemons, right? I mean, the evolutionary process will always, you know, take things forward no matter what, but like they were saying in that opening paragraph, if you just would, you know, stop using your free will in unfortunate ways and let the evolutionary process play out more, right? Let go of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices more. You'd be amazed at what the evolutionary process could do for you if you would just trust it, right? But again, we see, you know, in our current society, evolution is trusted less and less. People give lip service to it, at least biologic evolution, but they don't really trust the evolutionary process. Everyone is clamoring for some fiat act right now. It's like, well, you can't just let things play out, you know. You need to have some totalitarian grip, you know, that just snaps a finger and makes everything perfect tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah. In the meantime, we can tax you for it.
Yeah, it's like the Jewish priests tried that trick long ago. Right? It's not the way to go. You got to trust. Yeah. They should have said, you know, in my great humility, maybe Jeremiah had a point. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar decimating us, destroying the temple is exactly what we needed as a people. See, and that's why, you know, it's because of this sorts of things. This is why when all is said and done with the fifth epical revelation, all of us still have to humbly recognize that, a millennia or more of another dark ages might be exactly what this planet needs. Right? You can't say for certain that the planet doesn't need an interregnum. None of the revelators would declare that they know, right, that would be bad, right, in the long, you know, in the big picture. Right? They don't know. Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. Yeah, just a little reminder, right, to be humble about political affairs and whatnot of the world. All right, what else do they give us here?
During the captivity, the Jews were much influenced by Babylonian traditions and legends, although it should be noted that they unfailingly improved the moral tone and spiritual significance of the Chaldean stories which they adopted. Notwithstanding that they invariably distorted these legends to reflect honor and glory upon the ancestry and history of Israel.
So that, you know, that little paragraph just gives you a little detail about one of the positive aspects of being thrown in the water of Mesopotamia, as it were, to get these Jewish people out of their little circumscribed thought space, right, and put them in a bigger pool, right, where they can get some bigger ideas. I mean, you need that sort of stimulation, especially when you're starting with a volcano god. That's a pretty small little pool, concept pool that you're swimming in. So, it was like I said before, with, you know, we were talking about these ideas with Jeremiah. You start to talk like that, and someone with some solid Andite ancestry in Mesopotamia is going to, it's going to pause and perk up their ears. It's like, whoa, that sounds true. Right? They're going to recognize truth when they hear it, much more naturally than someone with lesser genetics. Right? Assuming they aren't using their better genetics and hence better ability to wield will upon themselves to blind themselves all the more. Right? But setting that aside, remember that's why there's an emergency here, right? The evolution of mind has finally overcome our limited genetics enough that we can have enough of a spiritualized mind and we can exercise will enough that we can be our own worst enemy to the point of an emergency now. To him whom much is given is much expected. Right? If you're given a more spiritualized mind and hence more a more volitional mind, okay, now it's in your hands, dude, right? For good or for ill. And in ignorance, it's ill, not good. All right, let's keep going.
These Hebrew priests and scribes had a single idea in their minds, and that was the rehabilitation of the Jewish nation, the glorification of Hebrew traditions, and the exaltation of their racial history. If there is resentment of the fact that these priests have fastened their erroneous ideas upon such a large part of the Occidental world, it should be remembered that they did not intentionally do this. They did not claim to be writing by inspiration. They made no profession to be writing a sacred book. They were merely preparing a textbook designed to bolster up the dwindling courage of their fellows in captivity. They were definitely aiming at improving the national spirit and morale of their compatriots. It remained for later day men to assemble these and other writings into a guidebook of supposedly infallible teachings.
Kind of like Paul's letters.
Yes, yes. Just like poor Paul's letters. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, I was just picking on the priests and their boat anchors. Okay, but I'm not picking on them as persons, not calling for the hatred of those priests long ago. Right, but it's just, this is the way it always goes. I mean, limitedly reflective people are always going to turn fancy words into sacred books, especially if those fancy words are self-affirming. It's like, well, this has got to be a sacred book. It says I'm God's gift to humanity, right? I mean, what further proof do we need? Right, so, the priests, could have known what would become of them. You know, in the same way Paul could have known. But, you know, you're down in the trenches, like you're pointing out. I mean, you know, a lot of it is just kind of material pragmatism, right? It's material pragmatism for Paul to write a letter to, you know, Galatia or something, right? Corinth. He's just trying to hold things together in a pragmatic way, just like the priests and scribes are trying to hold things together back then. Okay, but because we don't have the real stuff to turn to, you know, Prince and his staff, Adam and Eve and whatnot, right? I mean, we're always grasping for some human thing that we want to pretend in a clever species of self-deception, right, that it isn't just a human construct, even when it kind of overtly says it's just a human construct. We close our eyes to that part, wink, wink, and believe it's a sacred book given to us by the hand of God directly and is 100% infallible. And this is what we do because we're just so grasping. Right? We're so wishing we had the authority of the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve. That's why it's sad to record that so few persons take a hold of this book. right? The authoritative elimination of error. It's the authority that mankind has been looking for 200,000 years. Right? How sad is it that it's finally here and most people are don't get it, right? They're grasping white knuckle some secular authority or something, right? Some false authority. Right? The real authority has finally arrived. Right? But you know, there's been so many false authorities over the millennia, right? You can't really fault people too much for thinking, oh, it's just another thing. It's like, no. Actually, honestly, humbly read it. And you'll discover something very unexpected. Right? The real authority has arrived finally.
I think most folks aren't actually looking for a bona fide authority. I think they're comfortable in whatever's already put together in a kit.
I mean, you know, there's right. I mean, but you know, even if they don't think about it in terms of I'm looking for an authority, unconsciously that's what they're doing when they're looking for that established kit, right? I mean, you know, remember the threefold way of thinking about you know, a primitive religious mind, you know, your basic unreflective response to the sixth adjutant. You're looking you express yourself in terms of intellectual assent, credulity, and an identification with established authority. Not faith, trust, and assurance, intellectual assent, credulity, and established authority. Whether people recognize it or not, that's the modality that you naturally will function in. You know, even if it's purely secular, right, if that's your evolutionary religion, you approach your tribe, whatever kind of a tribe it is, says with, you strive to approach it with absolute credulity, right? You just swallow everything whole, nod, you know, and clap, and right. I mean, you know, because you've got this whole faith substitute of intellectual assent, right? You assent to it credulously, right? And you lean upon some established authority, right? The leaders of the party, or you know, or the denomination, or whatever, you know, tribal thing it is. Right? You know, I mean, sometimes it's kind of very in your face, like a pope. Right? Other times it's not so so overt, right? But it's always there. Right? Just there, you don't have faith, you have intellectual assent. You don't have trust, you have credulity. Right? And you don't have genuine internal assurance predicated on that trust. You don't need that. You're leaning fully on established authority.
But Katie has a point in terms of the fact that I don't think most people even think about it.
Yeah, right. They don't.
It doesn't even cross their mind. They're so wrapped up in, whether it's what's on their phone or what's what their problems are or their job or...
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever. And they do think about it when something, awful happens.
Right.
They need help, but other than that, it's just, most people I know, every time I bring it up, it's kind of like, they kind of like it in a way, but most people don't bring it up.
Yeah. Right. It all just goes under the radar. See, it's completely natural. It's not the product of a reflective life, so they're not thinking about it like you're saying. Right. It's just what happens naturally to our kind of a creature. It's just what you do naturally. Right? It's not bad. It's just child of God, right? I mean, it's just what you are naturally as a child of God, with a sixth adjutant and a few things, right? And when an encircling of the Holy Spirit that feeds concepts like sin into your mind, and then you proceed to, enumerate a list of taboos, that transgressing of which is a sin. You know, I mean, you try to, you know, you rationalize what sin is, what truth is, what spirit is, what, you know, et cetera. All these words that come down into you because you have your encirclement of the Holy Spirit.
But Chris, are you thinking in the 60s and 70s, people were thinking about it a whole lot more. It was really out front. People were looking. You know, every time you turned around, there was this or that. What's
even before that, in the 50s, there was a lot of real fertile, you know, thing. I mean, you know, campus ministry in the late 50s, early 60s was very fertile times. I mean, you know, there was this because, you know, remember, you've got the dawning of the sixth adjunct and the collective going on at that time. It's, you know, it's kind of sort of a, you know, a spiritual quickening sort of a thing.
Of a whole action, huh?
Right. Right. I mean, you have a collective sort of a phenomenon that everyone is, you know, is feeling, you know, that's sort of just in the water. And, right, you know, but that, you know, that, you know, the crest of that wave passes, right? You know, and it doesn't take long. And it just, everyone was, you know, had this initial kind of awakening feeling. But then what, you know, and they end up sort of just going off on all sorts of tangents and then starting to drift and feed back upon themselves and self-destructive behaviors and whatnot.
Authority has the word author. they've got to be a connection there. Mm-hmm. Now, when you talked about the whole being already in existence, in perfection, it's like that's the ultimate authority.
That's the authority, yes. Yeah.
So everything beneath that is like quasi-authority, sometimes authority.
Yeah, I mean, in that faith, trust, assurance triplet, right, the trust part, you know, it's a soul trust. Soul's a cosmic construct, right? That you're synchronizing with the whole and recognizing it, and in the innate perfection and integrity of the whole, you find assurance. Right? Now, and it starts with spiritual faith. It starts with you activating a nature that can potentially synchronize with the whole, followed by synchronizing with the whole, followed with, you know, feeling the assurance of having a place within that whole. You know, everyone wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. Why? Why does everyone want to be part of something bigger than themselves? Because you're innately programmed to seek the whole. That's the bigger than yourself thing that you're seeking, not some, you know, political movement or whatever, right?
Puny whole.
Right. Puny whole. Yeah. That, it's just, you know, it's built into us.
We understand that we're living out the story of God's people. I mean, that's kind of putting in that flowery terminology. But if you lose that, then you begin to think, well, I can make real whatever story I want.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the narrative. You know?
Right, and I have my truth, and, you know, right, you start thinking in those projecting of your subjectivity terms. Right. Whereas when you know the whole, you know that truth is a word referring to that whole, right, not the exaltation of a part.
Yeah.
But if you know not the whole, I mean, the only thing that you can imagine, you know that there's something exalted about the word truth. You can feel that. So you try to figure out how to exalt a part in some way and label it truth. Right? You know, like I said, I mean, you know, you fundamentally know that the word fact is a part word. There's that fact and that fact, right? You know, you're pointing at parts. But then you decide, not all facts are alike. Some facts are really vivid or something, you know. So those are truths, Right? You know that somehow this truth word is some exalted sort of a thing. So you exalt some facts into truths. You know, that's one modality of using the word truth. Right? It, all these different ways that you know, you're trying to, you know you've got this label. You're trying to figure out what to stick it on. Right? Once you recognize the whole, it's self-evident what the label applies to. It's like, oh, that's what that label applies to. No wonder I couldn't find a part that I could ever convince myself should be labeled with that.
Or trust anyone else's label.
Yeah, or trust anyone else. It's like, oh, I don't know. I don't think so. Yeah, it just never felt appropriate. You couldn't figure out why. And once you recognize the whole, then it's self-evident. Like, oh, wisdom is a word about the whole. Truth is a word about the whole. And all these things I've been trying to label apart with those words. No wonder I was struggling so.
Curse. Yeah. Seems easier to say curse because... Mm-hmm. I like to look at everything on a local level, even though I like also to look all the way to the Trinity Infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So the authoritative whole for us would be the Divine Minister, would it not?
Yeah, you have an initial, you know, wholeness. You know, that's why they use the word universe to define that domain, to describe that domain. There's one turning to it. There's a wholeness to it. Right? So your initial whole that you're trying to strike step with is that local wholeness, that downstepped expression of infinite wholeness, right? That is her... And what she embodies ubiquitously in the local universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you know, then you can start to get into more technicality of, okay, so now technically the way that Paradise Trinity is downstepped relative to her for the local universe is the whole. And she, as the mother, is the individuality of that whole, sort of the means through which you can know the whole.
The creative mother spirit.
The creative mother spirit, right?
But the divine,
yeah.
So there's the two aspects.
But you know, without getting too complicated, I mean, just, it's because of her that there's a wholeness that we can initially, put ourselves in the context of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's more possible to have assurance for me when I look at it as a local phenomenon.
Yeah.
Rather than beyond that. I just like to take one step at a time locally.
Yeah, and it's very important to do it because obviously the only way you're going to initially have some literalness to knowing this wholeness is her whole, you know, the local... local divine minister's wholeness. You're not going to somehow jump beyond her. And it's like, oh, I don't need her. I'm ready to, you know, engage the wholeness at the collective super universe level. It's like, no, you aren't. Right. So, I mean, it's just like thinking that you can imagine in some literal, direct fashion the nature of the universal father transcendent of the local father. It's like, no, your horizons aren't that wide yet.
Yeah, and we have two parents, of course.
Yeah, right.
But her authoritative wholeness really turns me on.
Yeah, right. I mean, and she, you know how directly, she's a downstep expression of the infinite mother spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that really big, ubiquitous wholeness there. At the co-infinite level, right? I mean, you know that, you know, that you are directly downstepping the infinite spirit to a creative spirit, and then mother is coming in as deity is coming in as a creative mother spirit, etc. You right? I mean, she is all of the substance of that infinite wholeness that we will ever need, as long as we're within the local universe. And we finally graduate, we need a bigger measure of wholeness, right? We've all grown. But you're not, you know, really leaving her behind. It's like we were saying early on. See, I mean, eventually, she wants you to be with her instead of in her. Mm-hmm. Right? When you graduate, okay, then you're with her, side by side.
Okay. I love it.
Right.
So with both parents, though, and we've covered this a lot, for me, I am in and through and with them. Both,
mm-hmm.
our first father, our Christ Michael, and the divine minister, creator, mother spirit, in and through and with. That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
And then...
we start out very in-wombed, you know, and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm okay staying with that for a long time because I'm not leaving anytime soon.
Yeah.
So...
All right. Let's see. Did we get everything there? We get up on these tangents. Okay. Yeah, the whole bit about. Oh, yeah, that's right. All right. They didn't intentionally do this whole sacred book thing. But yeah. So Paul's letters become infallible teachings, and you know, and whatnot. And well, they're giving. Notice they're giving you a little bit of context here in these first four paragraphs before they get to First Isaiah proper. And then afterwards we go in, you know, you'll see if you flip forward, you know, you have sacred and profane history and the whole Hebrew history. They get into all those details subsequently, but they wanted to put a little bit of it, you know, up front here. So you can better appreciate what happens with 2 Isaiah, as you'll see here.
The Jewish priesthood made liberal use of these writings subsequent to the captivity, but they were greatly hindered in their influence over their fellow captives by the presence of a young and indomitable prophet, Isaiah the Second, who was a full convert to the elder Isaiah's God of justice, love, righteousness, and mercy. He also believed with Jeremiah that Yahweh had become the God of all nations. He preached these theories of the nature of God with such telling effect that he made converts equally among the Jews and their captors. And this young preacher left on record his teachings, which the hostile and unforgiving priests sought to divorce from all association with him, although sheer respect for their beauty and grandeur led to their incorporation among the writings of the earlier Isaiah. And thus may be found the writings of this second Isaiah in the book of that name, embracing chapters 40 to 55 inclusive.
Okay, so I'll get to that last technical point here in a second. Notice kind of in the middle there what I alluded to earlier. He made converts equally among the Jews and their captors. See, just that fact that was equally tells you that we've gotten above anthropomorphic tribal God notions. Right? You've gotten up to spirit. There's no equally possible until you get up to spirit. So, you know, that's just, you know, a fantastic validation or verification of what he's achieved. That he's gotten up to the fact that there's one thing that we all have in common with no modifier. We're children of God. Period. There aren't Babylonian children of God and Hebrew children of God. There's just children of God. Right? Remember, in its fullness, when you're thinking about your personal nature and your relationship to the Universal Father, there isn't even male and female, right? Personalities aren't male or female. They're way transcendent of such things, right? Infinitely transcendent of such things.
So
what
they
do say.
Right. But then there's, right.
Eventually, you don't.
Right, but personalized selves, right, and if you use the word personality, it's shorthand for personalized self. I mean, there's definitely male and female personalized selves, right? But see, that's just all the challenge to, even though fully personalized selves, right, even finaliters, right, or whatever, right, you can tell the difference if they started male or female. But that just means the challenge is all the greater. Can you abstract personality itself from the self?
Yeah.
Right? Can you abstract something from one-time male finaliters and one-time female finaliters that is exactly the same, right, in both of them? Right? That's neither male nor female. Matter of fact, it's transcendent of all creatures, great and small.
It's not right?
There's only one. There's only two flavors: creator and creature personality.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, a divine counselor's personality is exactly the same flavor as yours. It's a creature personality. So you've got to get way up. You've got to transcend the. You know, think about. I mean, there will forever be a difference between you and a divine counselor, right? Even when the grand universe is settled in light and life, right? There's going to be all kinds of difference between you, the seventh stage spirit, and a divine counselor. But your personalities are transcendent of even that lofty nature and its differences. That's how rarefied a personality is. That's what you're trying to recognize in yourself. Like we've talked about, one of the ways that you can even now kind of get that is set aside all experiential nature in you or any other being, right? And just think about the existential core of their, you know, just the fact that they exist, the fact that you exist, right? There's only two flavors of your existing. Creator existing and creature existing. Yeah. Just thinking that purely existential thing, right? I mean, male and female have different experiences, not different existences. Right? They exist equally, identically the same.
Isaiah 1 and 2, I mean,
yeah.
It sort of makes it sound like they tried to hide the fact that there was an
Isaiah
2, did they?
Yeah, yeah, I was just going to get to that, and they definitely did.
Do most people not know that?
I'll explain how this all hangs together. So, but first of all, before we get to that, just notice, like I was hinting, they've given us first Isaiah and Jeremiah in many ways, so you just know what giant shoulders second Isaiah is standing on, right? He needed the shoulders of those giants to stand on. Second Isaiah was a transcendently insightful individual, but I mean, it's like saying that I could say anything that I've said for the last hour and a half if I hadn't found the Urantia book. No. Right, there wouldn't have been anything profound coming out of my mouth for the last hour and a half without the Urantia book. I'm nothing without it. Right? We all are dependent upon this assistance. And Second Isaiah was dependent upon those that went before him and climbed the lower rungs of the ladder so that he could stand on the top rung. Okay, so now the way this works, everyone that knows the Bible knows there's just the book of Isaiah. Okay, so on its surface, it appears there's just one person. But, long ago, as people very, very carefully studied the way the book is written, what language it uses, it became perfectly obvious that chapters 1 through 39 were written by one person, and chapters 40 through 55 are written by another person, and then 56 through 66 were an anthology, a collection. Okay, so scholars know that, you know, that those first two blocks of papers are written by what you could call First Isaiah and Second Isaiah. You know, and you know why they're just merged together and only scholarly analysis could tease it apart again. Because the priest saw to it that he got no separate billing. Okay. I mean, you know, and it's kind of silly because all you have to do is, I mean, it doesn't take, you know, lots of great analysis to have an initial suspicion. It's like, wait a minute, this person is talking like they're in exile already, and this person is talking like they aren't in exile yet. Right. I mean, it's pretty obvious that, you know, that they're speaking before and after First and Second Isaiah. After 55, after chapter 55, that collection, one of the things is, I'll leave the exercise to you, as you read the rest of this section, like if you go to the Perimony and look up, you know, where in Isaiah these quote-unquotes are that we're going to read, you'll see that some of them that they have here, that they tell you directly Second Isaiah said, are after chapter 55. So, you know, they're highlighting that, you know, some of the things that are mixed in with others in that third part of the book of Isaiah were written by Second Isaiah. Yeah. You know, obviously some of them are going to be written by First Isaiah, and some of them are probably written by others that were kind of just inspired. They're striking step. Okay. Because, you know, they've mentioned that you have these kind of these biggies like Jeremiah and Isaiah and whatnot, but there's lots of other individuals. Even they, you know, mentioned other prophets. Okay, so we're just hitting the high notes here. Anyway, so and I'll even point out to you when we hit the first one that's in that third part of the book of Isaiah. So. They hit it, but not from a discerning eye.
No prophet or religious leader from Machaventa to the time of Jesus attained the high concept of God that Isaiah the Second proclaimed during these days of the captivity. It was no small anthropomorphic man-made God that this spiritual leader proclaimed. Quote, "Behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing." Quote, "And as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts."
See, there it is, directly. No more puny God.
I know, I was just going to say, it's puny.
Yes. No small anthropomorphic man-made God. Right, that's the ghost cult God that you hear me talk about all the time. Not only is he small and anthropomorphic and man-made, that ghost called God, but he's all about material affairs. If it's too abstract when I just say ghost called God, it's like, you know, just think about, is your God notion about material issues? That's the ghost called God. Okay? Jesus said, no, that's not God. He's your spiritual father. Doesn't have anything to do with material stuff. Okay. But that's not the God that we naturally want. We made man-made God. We made the God that we naturally want. God who plays around with matter to our benefit.
God in man's image.
Okay. Who answers material prayers. Okay. That's the God you want. As an animal origin, the anthropomorphic creature, that's what you want, that's what you make, naturally. took a long time to fully turn that around, as they're talking about here. But here it is. So are my ways higher than your ways, right? My ways are not material ways. Your ways are material ways. Right? My ways are higher than that.
Unlike Yahweh's.
Yahweh's, yeah. okay, what else do we have here?
At last, Machaventa Melchizedek beheld human teachers proclaiming a real God to mortal man. Like Isaiah the First, this leader preached a God of universal creation and upholding. Quote, I have made the earth and put man upon it. I have created it not in vain. I formed it to be inhabited. I am the first and the last. There is no God beside me. Unquote. Speaking for the Lord God of Israel, this new prophet said, quote, the heavens may vanish and the earth wax old, but my righteousness shall endure forever and my salvation from generation to generation. Fear you not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. There is no God beside me, a just God and a Savior.
Okay. So first of all, notice, again, what you hear me say all the time in contrast to the ghost cult God notion. Right, they say it point blank there. At last, Machaventa Melchizedek beheld human teachers proclaiming a real God. Yeah. Not uploading the ghost cult God notion, downloading the real God. Right. That's the way to talk about this. That's the proper context. Real God, real means it's tied to eternity. Right. You're downloading it from eternity, not uploading it out of time. And then he look at these things like, I formed it to be inhabited.
So that in the first paper.
Right? Go beyond the immediacy of talking about the earth. The entire universe exists to be inhabited, period. Right? If there's something in existence right now that's not habitable, or that you know you can't imagine that it'll ever will be, well, it's not going to be there forever then. And he's like, well, what about suns? Right? I mean, eventually our sun is, made this object. And so you've got a lot of really transcendent questions you have to begin to think about. I mean, it's one thing to think about all of the, gas and dust and debris and, meteors and, extraneous planets and whatnot eventually disappearing, But, have you ever thought about that? There aren't suns in the central universe. You don't have planets orbiting uninhabitable balls of gas in the central universe. So, I mean, if you go way in the future, you've got some really interesting questions, How does this all work out in the really long term?
Because for now, when they swing into light and life, the suns are stable.
Right, they talk about making these suns eternal objects. It's like, well, okay, there's eternal and there's eternal. I mean, right? You're going to eventually transcend all the finite differences between the planet Earth and the sun, right? In Epsonity, right, you've transcended the finite differences between those two objects. What the heck does that even mean? Right? You transcend that which gives light is over there and that which receives light is over here. Right? Very imponderable stuff, right? When you start going that far. Yeah. Like I said, it's one thing to imagine somehow mysteriously all the extraneous matter being swept up in some way, but my goodness, you know.
Especially on the...
How does this all work?
All the space levels? I mean...
I mean, yeah.
It's like way beyond concept.
Right. Not to mention all the finiteness of all of the four outer space levels having to be transcended, too. Yeah. You know, you got the third and fourth haven't even really started yet, right? Let alone transcending their finiteness. I mean, good grief. It's just so incomprehensible. But you know, to just think in the, you've got some a point of reflection in what they tell you about the central universe. Yeah. It's like, huh, you know, that's the pattern for all the rest of the cosmos infinite. You know, and so exactly how will that all play out? But
yeah, maybe the sun's turned into a dark gravity body.
Right. I mean, you know, you've got you've got dark gravity bodies, and you've got the billion worlds, and you know, and then you've got the, you've got the three sets of seven satellites, fathers, sons, and spirits satellites, and you know how much radiance comes from the sun's worlds, you know, and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's all kinds of very interesting things. You know, the stuff that foreshadows that, like they tell you Eversa is around a star that, you know, shines with light without heat. In other words, that light without heat from the central universe is kind of being conducted out to that orb in some way. And there's all these things that are kind of foreshadowing future evolution of it.
Beyond the physics we know.
Yeah. See, and of course, the thing that really makes it impossible for us to think about is, there's no way we can get beyond thinking about the finite separations that we currently recognize. You know, right now there's so many finite miles between the sun and the earth. When you go to Ipsonity, you transcend all finite distances like that. I mean, what does the Ipsonite geometry of the super universe level look like even? See, when you don't have any finite angles or finite lengths, right? I mean, see, so that's why it seems so imponderable. But if you could look at it in an Ipsonite geometry, it's probably much less confusing. Things that you think are separate really aren't. See, when you take something that is altogether on an absolute level, the more you downstep it into absonity and then down into finiteness, the more separated it becomes. Right? So it, you know, we think that separation is real. It's like, no. Okay. Right? If you follow back up, there isn't it. I mean, you know, you follow matter and spirit all the way up to the Universal Father, and the separation between the two disappears. For instance. Like we say all the time, if I take all of the father fragments, imagine them in front of my eyes, if I flip them all around, I've got the force charge of space. So on the one side, I've got, you know, everything completely individuated, and on the other side, I have no individuation at all. What sense does that make to our minds? But you know it is the case nonetheless, conceptually. It has to be so, even if you can't imagine it. See, that's why I say we have to be able to see what we can't see right now, to see things in a geometry that's transcendent of the geometry that perforce we must assess everything within. Yeah.
Your personality has the dimensions for all of it.
Yep. You have absolute dimensions of your personality so that you'll be able to think completely in that absonite geometry. It's all built into you already.
It's okay.
Yep. It's kind of fun to just occasionally pause like, wow, that's really mysterious. I mean, just so that you don't let things just be prosaic. I mean, nothing is really prosaic. Everything is so transcendently mind-bogglingly cool. It's incomprehensible. Right? Just the fact that all I have to do is get my Morantia mind going on the imagined worlds, and I'll be able to think about things transcendent of time. I mean, just think how inscrutable that thought is. So, yeah, but it's just, you know, to leave yourself open for that infinitely transcendent mystery that awaits you as you ascend, right? And not hold on so tightly to the way things appear now, you know, and demanding that this must be forever, you know, just let go.
What am I
going to
get my grandkids?
Yeah, meanwhile, back on this planet, right, you know, you got to pay the water bill and right, and all that sort of stuff, right?
The coloring book of the geometry of the
axiom. Yeah.
You can't see it.
I mean,
yeah. I put color outside the lines.
Yeah. I mean, you'll remember there's a bit of that awaiting you once you get to the central universe. You're not going to experience it precisely like it's described in the Urantia book as a flat plane, right? You'll have some sort of, you know, absentite geometry sense. You know, I mean, what they give you in the book is just the projection of its absentite geometry onto the finite, and it projects planar in the finite. You know, just like the Isle of Paradise, you know, projects quasi-planar, pancake-like, you know, as a finite description. You know, what its higher geometry is, you know, is beyond our comprehension. Yeah, and like I said, you can kind of, you kind of actually already need to add in a little bit of quote-unquote higher geometry to the central universe to begin to appreciate your journey through it. You know, and thinking of kind of entering the plane on the pilot world of the seventh circuit, instead of staying in that plane, you know, think about going up a spiral as you go around the seventh circuit, and then hopping up to the pilot world of the sixth, and going, you know, so that you spiral up and in, you know, and that gives you a little more sense, not necessarily of the literal absentite geometry of it, but the fact that it's, you know, there's more to it than its initial apparent projection,
yeah.
Right? Because yeah, you know that you can't just walk horizontally on the plane and find the Isle of Paradise there in the center, right? They tell you it's not to be found there. You know, it's not a spot in finite geometry. So it's not at a location in finite geometry. So, all right, meanwhile, back to... and again, talking about 2nd Isaiah... It's not inappropriate to talk about such transcendent things. I mean, that's what they're trying to tell you. He's beginning to feel that, right?
Yeah.
Even if it's just kind of the spiritual nucleus of that, he's beginning to feel that transcendent space that is our destiny. Okay? And he's trying to give words to it, and sometimes does a really great job of it. All right. Oh, the other thing there. Do you need Jesus to get fear not? No. 2nd Isaiah's got it. Fear you not. It's right there.
Yeah. Well, his fear not, Jesus, was predicated on
this
God.
Yeah, right. It's like, have you not read?
Right.
Right? I mean, a lot of things, Jesus just had to remind you of what 2nd Isaiah said.
You guys should know this.
Right? It's just like, okay, this is not new. Right? Told a long time ago. Right?
You know, what does it matter if true son of God if the whole world disappears? Is kind of what he's saying here.
Yeah, right. Seen. Just see how. I mean, it's in many ways, Jesus is there to just take these gems and lift them up to where they should be. You know, amongst all the, you know, health laws and, you know, in the first five books or something, right?
He probably knew them by heart too, right?
Yeah, yeah, you know how he just quoted all these things just off the top of his head.
It's always been this way. there's a lot of truth has been expressed and no one recognizes it. Because they're waiting for an authority.
It's like I sent you Amos, I sent you Micah, I sent you, you know, 2nd Isaiah, I sent you Jesus, I said, you know, how much more, right? Okay.
And it comforted the Jewish captives, as it has thousands upon thousands ever since, to hear such words as, quote, "Thus says the Lord, I have created you, I have redeemed you, I have called you by your name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, since you are precious in my sight. Can a woman forget her suckling child, that she should not have compassion on her son? Yes, she may forget, yet will I not forget my children. For behold, I have graven them upon the palms of my hands. I have even covered them with the shadow of my hands. Let the wicked forsake his ways, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon."
Right. I mean, you know, remember how strong an identification the maternal instinct is? My identification is even stronger. Right? Because you know sometimes that even that is thrown aside, unfortunately. But my identification, never. Right? I change not. I see all these really great statements. Right? Are you by nature sinful and unclean? No. You are mine.
Precious in my sight.
Right. Like I said, I mean, see, in many ways, Jesus is just trying to say, have you not read?
Don't tell that to a
cat. It's there, right? Just pull the pearls out of the mire, you know, that Jeremiah was thrown into. They're there.
Yep. As Jesus was growing up and learning and studying, he was reading Isaiah.
Yeah. And resonating with it deeply. Like I said, I doubt if I could actually read this out loud. I'd start breaking down. I mean, some of it is so cool. Yeah. All right, let's keep going.
Listen again to the gospel of this new revelation of the God of Salem. Quote, "He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs in his arms and carry them in his bosom. He gives power to the faint, and to those who have no might he increases strength. Those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint."
Like that passage. When you get to the wings as eagles line, you know, that's really cool stuff. You know, just, you know, sit by yourself, you know, and allow yourself to just feel that. Yeah, let it, you know, impact you.
Have you gotten any of the part that's at 55?
No, not yet, I'll tell you. getting close. Yeah, all of this is in 40 through 55 so far.
If you ever went to church, you hear this all the time.
Yeah.
It's very familiar.
Yes, yeah, very familiar. Next time we'll get to one of the reasons why it's so familiar. But you know, as the Christians latched onto these things, but you know, just look at the way they start. Listen again to the gospel of this new revelation, right? And reminding you that this is finally, Machaventum Melchizedek is finally smiling, you know, my efforts were not in vain. Thank goodness for the spiritual quickening of the 6th century B.C.
Kind of a surprising tone they take. I don't recall very often where they just shift into that directive mode where they're just telling us to do something. You know,
like, listen.
Yeah.
Right. Like I've been trying to stress. It's like, you know, just, as I said, you know, go by yourself and listen, right, to what's being said. Let it penetrate into you and find its home deep in your heart.
This Isaiah conducted a far-flung propaganda of the gospel of the enlarging concept of a supreme Yahweh. He vied with Moses in the eloquence with which he portrayed the Lord God of Israel as the universal creator. He was poetic in his portrayal of the infinite attributes of the universal Father. No more beautiful pronouncements about the Heavenly Father have ever been made. Like the Psalms, the writings of Isaiah are among the most sublime and true presentations of the spiritual concept of God ever to greet the ears of mortal man prior to the arrival of Michael on Urantia. Listen to his portrayal of deity. Quote, "I am the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity. I am the first and the last, and beside me there is no other God. And the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear." Unquote. And it was a new doctrine in Jewry when this benign but commanding prophet persisted in the preachment of divine constancy, God's faithfulness. He declared that, quote, "God would not forget, would not forsake."
So the very first time that they go into the third block of chapters in the book of Isaiah is right there after his portrayal of deity, quote, "I am the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity. Right, that's getting into that third block. Yeah. And so there's like half a dozen from here to the end of the section that they mix in with ones from, you know, the one that's just him. You know, it's just him from 40 to 55. Let's see. You know, so you can kind of be suspicious as you're reading through those latter chapters. Well, that sounds very soaring and transcendent. I wonder if that's second Isaiah. Okay, let's see. Oh, I mean, you know, again, just notice how unqualified, right? I mean, some of these statements are, no more beautiful pronouncements about the Heavenly Father have ever been made. Okay, I mean, they bring in Jesus' incarnation, okay, but they're including everything there, right? I mean, like we were just saying, I mean, Jesus didn't need to pen his own words. He just quoted 2 Isaiah. Because no more beautiful pronouncements about the Heavenly Father have ever been made. You know, you sort of just, there's a limit to what a human language can express. And you sort of just, you reach the ceiling in some ways. You know, especially when you're kind of just focusing on the ideal, you know, the universal Father. You know, there's to get some more transcendent expression, you're going to need Marantia mind and a Marantia language of some sort, like the local universe tongue. We've seen that. You know, they mentioned Psalms. Remember how they said they were so unqualified in what they said about the Psalms too. Right, so. So again, it's, Jesus is really handy, like the Urantia book is. You know, you see what things Jesus held up in the Hebrew scriptures. Right? He was very handy for saying, focus on these, okay, forget about the other stuff, basically. You know, just the way the Urantia book only quotes some things. Right? Again, it's that, you know, they're trying to help you to lift, like I said, the pearls up out of the mire. Right? And in many ways, see that as the spiritual uplifter, that's what Jesus' job was. Not to originate a lot of new words, you know, but to uplift the ones that were there that should be held above the others. In the same way that the authors of this book were told that don't pen your own words if you can find a human that's already said it.
What's of spiritual value?
What is of spiritual value? Right? What is what is definitively about the inner life? When you say spiritual, what's the immediate point of invoking that word relative to your mind. The main point is you have no control over the influence that matter has upon your mind, right? The material phenomena get represented in your mind whether you want them or not. Right? I mean, you can try closing your eyes and, you know, and humming and whatnot, you know, but it's very difficult. You know? You can't just say no and they stop. Spirit also can influence your mind, but unlike with matter, you have control, free will control on how spirit influences your mind, how it how it is represented in your mind. And so to say spiritual value, you know, see, there's, you know, you're invoking this this concept that you can bring in a framing for your mind that you have control over, and you can direct in a way to better deal with the inescapable influence that matter has on your mind. It's really good news that you're not a helpless victim of antecedent causation from matter.
That antidote to matter question.
Yeah.
Thoroughly.
Yeah.
If you had to be in control of something, that's what you're going to be in control.
Right. You have an antidote, right, to that material influence. You can take control of the situation. See, that's of real value. See, and you begin to feel the difference between what the word value is referring to, contrast to, say, material worth. There's, you know, it's very handy to have a table to set a cup on. Right? That's worth something. Right? But is it of spiritual value?
Depends on what you do with it.
Try to figure, you know, what exactly is the difference between the word value and the word worth?
You know, things that have value and things that don't.
Right. Okay. Maybe just, you know, conducted a far-flung propaganda. Propaganda isn't an innately negative word.
I was just going to say,
right?
It's got a lot of baggage with it, but it doesn't deserve.
I mean, is it a good thing that we propagate?
Exactly.
Yes. Be fruitful and multiply, right? someone mentioned Catholic, the word propaganda got official technical usage, in the Roman Catholic Church, where it starts to have a capital P on it, you're trying to propagate ideas, just like you propagate plants or animals or yourself.
This daring teacher proclaimed that man was very closely related to God, saying, quote, "Everyone who is called by my name, I have created for my glory, and they shall show forth my praise. I, even I, am he who blots out their transgressions for my own sake, and I will not remember their sins."
Blots out their transgressions for my own sake. He can't see sin. All right, so being all worried about, what does God think of this sin that I just committed? He's blotted it out for his own sake, right? And I will not remember their sins, right? Because he never saw them. It's easy to not remember something you never saw, right? The same way it's easy to forget if you never take offense. God never takes offense. So forgiveness is automatic.
It's a good thing because it's blame for him.
Yeah. If it weren't so.
Now, and so when you think about how many times I've kind of stressed this idea, you know, in various places. We're reading the Urantia book, and it kind of comes up. It's like, this is not a new thing. No, Second Isaiah said it, right? But does a basic Christian live his life knowing what Second Isaiah told him about God? No, no. They're still in the old ghost cult debt mode, or they think they need atonement.
Here, this great Hebrew demolished the concept of a national God, while in glory he proclaims the divinity of the universal Father, of whom he says, quote, "The heavens are my throne, and the earth is my footstool." And Isaiah's God was nonetheless holy, majestic, just, and unsearchable. The concept of the angry, vengeful, and jealous Yahweh of the desert Bedouins has almost vanished. A new concept of the supreme and universal Yahweh has appeared in the mind of mortal man, never to be lost to human view. The realization of divine justice has begun the destruction of primitive magic and biologic fear. At last, man is introduced to a universe of law and order, and to a universal God of dependable and final attributes.
If only he could keep reminding himself of that, like I said. The introduction was made long ago. Demolish, destruction. You see those words in that paragraph? This is eventually what you need to do as an individual. You can't expect the main evolutionary stream to turn on a dime, but you can just choose this day to be done with the ghost called God, like I was saying last week. Demolish him in your mind, right? Destroy all this primitive magic and biologic fear. Just wipe it off your slate, right? And have nothing to do with it anymore. Like they're saying there, that's what, he's putting forward that challenge. You are sovereign in that place. If you say erase it, no one can say otherwise. Just be done with it in your inner life. Right? You can't help but be impacted in your lower domain by the environment that you live in, that's fraught with fear and whatnot. But be done with fear in the inner sanctum. Do not allow it in. Erase what's there and let none in ever again, period. Right? It
takes practice. If you were brought up the other way.
Right, because when you're brought up the other way, you've unwittingly drug all that junk up into that upper domain and existentialized it, right? And think that, you're just stuck with it. It's like, no, you're sovereign there. Take a hold of the reins, right?
Practice.
And just, even if, it takes a while to overcome the material inertia in there, I mean, you can at least know conceptually otherwise, period, end of story. Right? You will never let any doubt about it creep in again. Right? Just be definitive. They purposely use those strong words to remind you of your free will power in there. The concept of an angry, vengeful, and jealous Yahweh of the desert Bedouins has almost vanished. Like I said, that's the process. You start out with a nugget where he's gone, but you got the rest of the whole sweeping conception that you've got to work through yet. But they're pointing out it's penetrating, and is almost from horizon to horizon. There's not a lot of sentences that you have to kind of just skip over. It's like, there's the volcano God again. Let's skip that sentence. Jesus was great at skipping over the sentences where the old stuff was creeping in, right? Or the revelators, when they use this stuff, you know, they'll just skip or rewrite parts, right? To purify it of the ghost called God stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that it is completely vanished instead of almost vanished.
And this preacher of a supernal God never ceased to proclaim this God of love. Quote, I dwell in the high and holy place, also with him who is of a contrite and humble spirit. Unquote. And still further words of comfort did this great teacher speak to his contemporaries. Quote, and the Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your soul. You shall be like a watered garden, and like a spring whose waters fail not. And if the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord will lift up a defense against him. Unquote. And once again did the fear-destroying gospel of Melchizedek and the trust-breeding religion of Salem shine forth for the blessing of mankind.
Fear-destroying gospel of Melchizedek, like I was just stressing. And the trust-breeding religion of Salem, right? Faith, trust, assurance. Remember how the whole bit of trust and faith for the of the third epical revelation. Remember when you do that, it was in that order, trust and faith, because you're starting with just trying to get the faith foundation so that you can have some trust. But then once you've got that, now let go of that foundational faith that is still in relationship to fear, right? And put a living faith on top of that trust foundation.
What was Jesus' salvation in love?
Love and service.
Love and service.
Service. So, yeah, again, this whole the trust and the. The trust breeding and the fear destroying, so you go hand in hand. The more trust that's bred, the more fear is destroyed. Right. Once you fully trust, there's no place for fear to exist anymore. It just has no domain anymore.
The far-seeing and courageous Isaiah effectively eclipsed the nationalistic Yahweh by his sublime portraiture of the majesty and universal omnipotence of the supreme Yahweh, God of love, ruler of the universe, and affectionate father of all mankind. Ever since those eventful days, the highest God concept in the Occident has embraced universal justice, divine mercy, and eternal righteousness. In superb language and with matchless grace, this great teacher portrayed the all-powerful Creator as the all-loving Father.
Again, just see, God is your spiritual Father. It's just a booster shot that Jesus was doing. See, again, he's just trying to uplift that, that second Isaiah declared.
And that's what they said. Jesus wasn't the first to introduce the concept of God the Father.
Yes.
This was definitely.
Right. So, like all revelation, whether it's Jesus of Nazareth or the Urantia Papers, they're trying to bring things into focus. Maybe just saying, focus on this, have you not read, Maybe it's kind of directly that they're trying to bring things into focus by just holding up one thing in front of your face. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to bring things to a focus for you. And then you can take it from there. They can catalyze your focus, and you've got it.
Surprise, he didn't fuse, too.
Right, yeah. And then you get into those second ideas. Isaiah didn't fuse, right? Right. The whole mystery of fusion, yes.
The whole philosophy.
Now, you can kind of understand that he's pretty heavy on the ideal side, as opposed... He's sort of just using the cosmic gift that we're all given by grace very well, as opposed to, perhaps making great advances right, in bringing material pragmatism and spiritual idealism together beyond what we're given by grace. And again, it just reminds you, what you're given by grace will go a long ways, okay? Right. If we all just used that initial encirclement, the entire planet would be completely transformed.
Yeah, if these guys kept fusing, there wouldn't be anybody here to... You know, last time it happened with Elijah, it took two other guys.
Right, exactly. Yep. All right, then we'll wrap it up here.
This prophet of the captivity preached to his people and to those of many nations as they listened by the river in Babylon. And this second Isaiah did much to counteract the many wrong and racially egoistic concepts of the mission of the promised Messiah. But in this effort, he was not wholly successful. Had the priests not dedicated themselves to the work of building up a misconceived nationalism, the teachings of the two Isaiahs would have prepared the way for the recognition and reception of the promised Messiah.
So we started with the problematic priests, and we ended with the problematic priests. Yeah. So all of that difficulty that Jesus had, he's laboring under their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, about the Messiah, that basically he finally just had to give up on. He could not break them from it, That's just how unwittingly, in many ways, effective those priests were in their construct. And look at the words they use, wrong, they used in there, and misconceived, again, wrongly conceived. Just a little technical thing, as they listened by the river in Babylon, which of the two rivers is that? It's the Euphrates, yes. Because remember, back in ancient times, that Nadite headquarters was just south of the point where the two get close there. The two rivers just south of that, on the Euphrates side. Yeah, right there in that area where the second garden was. On the west side, on the Euphrates side of where the second garden was.
Is that where Baghdad is?
No, Baghdad is on the Tigris.
Oh, okay. So it's
right there. Yep. All right. Like I said, then next time we'll actually now kind of more methodically start stepping through the history itself rather than hitting the highlights of the prophets. So let's just take a little moment here.